It was called The Trial of the Century, and man, did it live up to every bit of that. The O.J. Simpson murder trial, he was accused and acquitted of killing his ex-wife, who he was having a custody battle with over the children, which is something familiar that we're going on with here in Connecticut, and the murder of Ron Goldman. On the phone right now with us is Kim Goldman, Ron's sister. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
I feel like I've mourned with your family, and I feel like I watched the whole thing unfold on television, and you know, I feel a connection to you that I'm sure a lot of people you never met feel.
Well, so, I appreciate that. It feels very nice, and yes, we hear that often, and that means the world to us.
One of my saddest days during that whole ordeal was watching your father break down and cry on television, and I felt like your family had great poise throughout the whole trial.
Yep.
And when he lost it that day, I mean, I was you know, I was a wreck as well. It was just, the whole thing was difficult to watch. How old were you when the killer murdered your brother?
I was 22. My brother was 3.5 years older than me, so I was just 22 as a baby.
How did you find out that Ron was murdered?
My dad. We were told, my dad found out at about 5 o'clock, the day after the murders. It was on the news all day in Los Angeles, but my brother's name hadn't been released because they hadn't made contact with our family yet. And I was living in San Francisco at the time, working and going to school. And my dad called my boyfriend that I was living with at the time and told him to wait for me, told him what happened. And I came home, and my boyfriend was like, you got to get on the phone with your dad. It's urgent. No, he didn't say it's urgent. He just said, you have to talk to your dad. And I was annoyed because I just walked in the door. And finally, I gave in, and I called my dad. And he said, you know, did you listen to the news at all today? And I said, no. He said, you know, Ron died. And he asked about Nicole Brown, and I didn't know who that was. And it just, hearing the pain in my dad's voice, and we did not know anything that was going on at that point, despite what was on the news. We just didn't have any information. And then the rest is history.
It had to have been surreal for you to not only have your brother murdered, but it to be such a famous person. And then, you know, it's such a public event
worldwide.
And it's, yeah. I remember my nephew was 27 years old, hit on the side of the Merritt Parkway, died instantly. And just watching, and this is a, you know, this was a one news cycle event, but watching the news and then seeing his sneaker and seeing his body covered on television, I thought it was such a massive invasion of privacy. I felt naked, and it was such a feeling that shot through me. And now you had to deal with this with the whole world and a prolonged trial. I mean, it had to be horribly difficult for you to go through that.
Well, you know, I'm so sorry for your loss. You know, I think that nothing prepares you for when tragedy strikes, and for us particularly, yeah, you're right, to have it, you know, be so publicized. It was hard because we had no idea what we were up against. I mean, I had no idea who, you know, O.J. Simpson was. I wasn't a football fan at the time and never heard of him. I didn't have any idea how beloved he was. So we had no clue at what was about to happen. And it was incredibly hard. I mean, there was no reprieve. There was no anonymity. There was no safety from any of it. However, the flip side of that is that people did, like you said in the beginning, feel a connection to our family. And so we felt a lot of love and a lot of support. And as invasive as it feels, sometimes that also helps. But because it is so public, it continues. And, you know, here we are 25 years later. And even if I didn't have my podcast, it's still so widely talked about. So,
yeah, it's, It's incredible. I know it's the most famous murder case in my lifetime, and I think it spans further back than that. Being in the courtroom, and he's just a few feet away, the person who murdered your brother, what was that like, and were there times you wanted to just shout stuff out?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I'd never been inside of a courtroom before. Despite how fast I drive, I don't think I even had a speeding ticket at that time. I just didn't. It was so bizarre to me, and it was hard because he was so close, but there was so much going on, and it was hard to process. But my job, I felt, was just to be you know, stand vigil every day, every time I went to court. And so whenever he would come in the courtroom, I would just stare at him and, you know, just make sure he knew I was there. That was sort of the only way I could keep my composure. And it was really hard to keep quiet. We weren't allowed to have any emotional responses to things. We weren't allowed to have any, you know, real visible facial reactions to things. I mean, we were under a very watchful eye from the judge, and that was hard. So I grimaced a lot and wrote notes and pinched myself so I could stop from screaming. But yeah, it's incredibly difficult.
The moment where he's trying to put the glove on and he's like has his hand all stretched out so the glove doesn't fit on his hand.
Yeah.
I'm like, how did you not scream? Come on, you're faking it.
Right.
Put the glove on.
He seemed kind of smug. Did he ever like try and like smile at you or look at you, acknowledge you at all?
Not at that time. Other times he did. The day of the glove, you know, that was bizarre because it happened very quickly. And I do remember thinking, oh my God, it's Fitz. Like, what is he doing? I could see, you know, because I knew what was going on. I knew what led up to it. And I did see him like extend, you know, like bend his fingers a little bit so that the glove didn't fit. I mean, it was all an act. But you know, you have to maintain some level of decorum because I didn't want to be the reason that anything bad would happen because I was just trusting the process. I mean, again, I was 22.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was raised to, you know, you listen to your elders, you respect the law, you follow the rules, you know, so I just was on my best behavior. But it was horribly hard because there was so much crap being slung that how do you not lash out and scream? And, you know, that's why we were lucky that the media sometimes will allow us to kind of unleash after a day of trial.
The other thing is a typical murder trial lasts 2 weeks. This went on for a year. A year.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to be outraged. Like, you know, come on. Let's, you know, all right, maybe it's a month because it's a celebrity. But almost a year. It was unreal.
Yeah. And I don't tend to extend a tremendous amount of compassion for the jury, but you know, that is one thing that I have to be mindful of, that they were sequestered for that whole time. But that's also, you know, honestly, another reason why I wanted to do my show is because I wanted to talk about how much it impacted people. You know, it was, you know, 9.5 months of trial, but it lasted far much longer than that, and what people endured and what people sacrificed and what happened in the wake of the trial to people's lives. I think that's forgotten. You know, people that were watching just saw snippets of it or, you know, watched it all day long on TV, but it really did carry through to people's family and home life and career, and it stays with you, and it doesn't get easier just because you turned off the television.
When Johnny Cochran was doing that, let me just, before I go into that, it was so weird that it took so long, but also it becomes this thing where people forget that two people were brutally butchered when you see Jay Leno come on and do the dancing Itos.
Yeah.
I'm watching this. I'm like, okay, does anybody realize what's going, like two people were killed.
Yeah.
I don't know. I give you guys a lot of credit for getting through that, having the strength to get through that with the composure that you did. Now, Johnny Cochran's closing argument during that, did you or could you sense in the courtroom that how effective that ended up being?
I mean, yes, because it's twofold. I knew how how enamored the jury was with the defense team. I mean, that was very obvious from the beginning. There was a tremendous amount of disdain that they felt for the prosecution. So every time the defense got up, there was like, hey, you know, like they just felt more relaxed. Like you could see, you know, they responded to them. So leading into the final arguments, I mean, I thought that that's how they felt. And then, you know, when he was doing his nursery rhymes about glove not fitting and all that stuff, you know, they fell for it. The jury fell for that. And however, having said that, I didn't think that we would get not guilty. I think I still thought how could they? You know, I think that's what happens. I mean, and I've said this for years that my brain and my heart don't always line up. So logically, I think I probably realized it, but in my heart, I didn't believe it could happen.
Has there ever been so much evidence?
Yeah.
You know, when you leave your footprints, and I don't want to go through the whole thing, but
a lot of evidence.
Footprints. All right. So here's one glove.
Yep.
And I'll leave the other glove at my house.
There's a spot of blood in the truck.
It was in the cut on the hand matchup, and I don't have to go through. It was, you know, Marcia Clark did say it was a mountain of evidence, and it really was a mountain of evidence. But the mistake that they made is when, you know, it was right after Rodney King.
And the podcast, I asked Marcia about that on the second episode, and we talked about the jury pool and make the decision to move it from Santa Monica to where the murders were all, because you're supposed to have the trials were in the jurisdiction where the crime happened. And it was moved downtown. And the reason that she gave me, and I kind of understood it, the Santa Monica courthouse only has a limited amount of courtrooms. And the criminal courts building downtown Los Angeles has endless numbers of courts, and it could handle the size of the case. It could handle the media, the need for there to be so many people. I don't know. I mean, I don't need to go through every specific example, but it was basically, they said it was because of the size of the case. And if they had the case in Santa Monica, it would have clogged the system in Santa Monica. And because they don't have that much space, it would have backed up their entire system. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, high profile cases, they said, were downtown LA. But as a result, it did, you know, have a different jury pool. You know, that was a result of that. But again, they probably felt it didn't matter because, like you said, we had so much evidence.
It was so much. It was so blatant. It's incredible. We're kind of dealing with that now. We're in the beginning stages of a murder mystery, but we all kind of know what happened. We have a missing mom. She's been missing for 30 days, and yeah, she was in the middle of a very contentious divorce, and her estranged husband. Let's just say that the evidence leads us to believe that he did it. They haven't arrested him on those charges, but just evidence tampering, because they caught him throwing away some garbage bags, according to police, with her blood on it. And it's one of those, it's very, to me, my opinion, it's very obvious who did this, but, you know, I think we look back at this with your brother, Ron, and we can see that it doesn't matter how much evidence you have, it could go the other way. Like, do you have any advice, one, to that family, and two, to anyone who might be on a jury pool for this?
First to the family, you know, you have to show up, you have to ask questions, you have to go to court, you have to be part of the process, you have to demand that you are pulled into the fold when it comes to knowing what's happening with the investigation, what's happening with, you know, charges being drawn, and then showing up to court. You have an advocate that's available to you. I mean, you have to keep your face in front of the team of people that are advocating for the loss of your loved one. It helps. Most prosecutors and district attorney's offices will tell you that they want the support of the family. And as hard as it is, I encourage them to muster the courage to show up every day, because it matters. And then to know that they're not alone and they can reach out and ask for help. I'm available if they need any extra support, because it is incredibly isolating to be in that process. But to potential jurors, show up for jury duty. It really frustrates me to hear people try to talk about how they want to get out of jury duty.
Right.
That's your civic duty, man. I mean, I just feel like, I know it's painful to pull yourself away from your family. I get all that, but the alternative is that you could not give justice to a family that deserves it. And I think we need to do a better job at making that a more important job in our country. I think people blow it off like it's an inconvenience to them, but I really feel like that's our job. You know, if you get called, you don't get called all the time. It's not an everyday occurrence. And our employers need to do better at making that more accessible to people so that they don't use financial hardship as a reason to not show up, but just show up and do your job, stay present, and stay present till the very end. Our jury gave up halfway through. So
now, your family's so classy. You're probably above this, but I'm not. So I'm going to ask this question. Was there a sense of justice for you or a sense of comfort when, OJ went to prison, even though it was unrelated charges?
Oh, yeah. I mean, okay. I when we found out that he was arrested, we had just been forced to publish the If I Did It book, which was the hypothetical confession, of a hypothetical account of what happened that night from the killer's point of view. And we were forced to publish that book from a long list of legal issues. So it was the day that the book came out that he broke into the hotel room and stole all that stuff. And when he was arrested, my dad and I were busting up laughing. I was thrilled. And then to find out that he was found guilty, we were able to be in the courtroom for the sentencing. I didn't feel a sense of relief. I felt thankful. I felt appreciative that the system worked in that case. And yes, there were a lot of people that thought it was retribution for what happened in Los Angeles, and maybe it was, and I was okay with that.
Was there any feelings or thoughts about some of the attorneys on the defense getting ill and dying? Was that any kind of a sense of karma or universe at
payback.
Work?
Well, that's where the classy line comes into play here.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, that's hard. I mean, I didn't feel sorrow when I heard, you know, that a couple of them passed away or were disbarred, or it was just a feeling of nothingness. I don't know that I could say it felt like karma. I just didn't feel anything.
Yeah.
And I, you know, they hit below the belt. You know, they didn't have to. I get the need to defend your client and to, you know, fight hard to make sure that your client is protected, but they went above and beyond, and they went far below the line of, in my view, what's ethical and what's honest and what's with integrity. And so there was no love loss there with any of them.
Well, in my mind, Kardashian disposed of the murder weapon. There's footage of him like the next day or, you know, a day or so after leaving the property with a bag. And everyone kind of believed that that was him taking the murder weapon out.
Yeah.
And then Johnny Cochran is the guy with that closing argument. Yeah, I don't know. When I saw that happen, I'm like, check and check. There's someone watching and keeping score of all this
exactly
stuff.
Exactly right.
But that's me. See, like, I'm not as classy
as you. You can't fool karma.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I just, you know, I have to limit the amount of feelings I can have. And so I've chosen to just target my anger towards the one person that killed my brother, because I can't. I mean, I'd be here forever.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to manage that anger and that grief, and then also try to be a productive member of society and raise my kid and be an advocate and run a business and, you know, do my podcast, you know? And so it's, I have to reserve. My reserve tank sometimes gets really low. So
that makes sense, and it sounds like you got it figured out.
Yeah,
it goes back to the family that we saw go through this whole nationally exposed and televised trial. You're just as a side note, your son's middle name is Ronald, named after your brother, which is I think beautiful.
Yeah.
Your podcast, Confronting O.J. Simpson, 10-part podcast, recommended to everyone. And do you have a weekly podcast as well, correct?
No, I did for a handful of years, but this is the one that I'm focusing on now. And this one, there's 4 episodes. They drop every download. I don't know what the word is. Every Wednesday. And so this one is the one I'm working on right now.
All right, Confronting O.J. Simpson. We will link up to it on WPLR.com. Kim, thank you for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right.
Bye. Okay,
bye-bye. Chaz and AJ, Napoli Nissan of Milford News.
Now, we have the missing mom mystery here in Connecticut, and I feel like people, including myself, believe it's the husband. One, because of the evidence, and two, because when something like this happens, it's generally the husband.
Right, or the butler, one of the two.
Right.
You don't have a butler, so the husband.
Right. John Douglas is on. He's a legendary FBI criminal profiler. He's co-author of The Killer Across the Table. Hey, John.
Hey, guys, you already got something wrong. This is Mark Olshaker, his co-writer.
Oh, right. The other guy.
Yeah, the other guy.
We were testing you, making sure you knew.
John is not feeling well right now, so you got me instead.
Well, you're the one we wanted to begin with.
Exactly, so.
So we're happy about that. But tell John we wish him the best.
Yeah. I sure will.
All right. So, yeah, John, it was a last-minute switch last night, right?
That's right.
All right, Mark, thank you for coming on. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Are you an FBI profiler?
No, I am not. I am a writer. I am a film producer. And John and I got together years ago when I was writing and producing a film for Nova, the PBS science series, based on the real story behind the Silence of the Lambs guys, the FBI's behavioral profiler.
Oh, wow.
It was called Mind of a Serial Killer. It was on PBS. It did very well. And a few years later, when John got ready to retire, he called me and said, do you think anybody would be interested in my story? And I said, well, I certainly am. Let's see what happens. We'll go to New York and pitch it. We did. The book that came out of it was Mindhunter, which our first book together, which, as you would know, is now a series on Netflix, going into its second season very soon, and it did very well. We continued. The rest is history. The book we have out now, The Killer Across the Table, I think is our 8th book on profiling and criminal investigative analysis, and here we are.
What is it that, how do you profile someone?
Well, it's not what people think, and it's also not the 23-year-old male loner, et cetera. There's a lot more that goes into it. Basically, what this book is about and what profiling is about is John had the idea many years ago, back in the 1970s and 80s, to go into the penitentiaries and actually talk to the real killers. John always said, to understand an artist, you have to look at his art. And in this case, this is these people's art, as perverse as that sounds. And by talking to people like Charles Manson, Ed Kemper, Richard Speck, who murdered 8 student nurses in Chicago, by talking to these people and finding out, doing a deep dive into what was in their minds before, during, and after their crimes, he was able, for the first time, to correlate that with the evidence left at the crime scene. So that's what profiling is. It's looking at evidence. It's going back to this store of information about these guys and trying to predict and give police a sense of what kind of person, what kind of characteristics committed this crime, and therefore to narrow their focus in a very efficient way.
How do they come up with that? So I'm trying to figure out, how do they come up with white male, 35 to 45? How do they guess the age? Probably in this occupation,
right.
Probably driving yeah. like an understated plane car,
right.
something that looks like an unmarked police car. How do they connect all those dots based on evidence?
Well, there's a lot of ways you do it, and part of it has to do with the presentation of the body, where the crime is staged. There are a lot of things, and for instance, one may follow from another. In the case of Christine Elverson, one of John's early cases in New York, a young special education teacher was found murdered and very ritualistically displayed on the stair landing on the top of her apartment building in the Bronx. Based on the presentation, the odd arrangement of things, the fact that the crime looked like it was spontaneous but then very ritualistic, John came up with, after 3 years of no response from the police, John came up with a profile that said, this person is a disheveled white male loner in his thirties or late twenties. He probably doesn't have a car. He's probably on psychic medication. He lives with a parent or older female relative within a certain area of the building. He probably was known in the building, et cetera, et cetera. And all this came from the presentation and the fact that he said he does not drive, probably, and that's related to his mental incapacity, which he saw from the strange ritualistic positioning of objects around the body. And when he told all this to the police, they said, oh, and the other thing he said is, and you've probably already interviewed him because you would have interviewed people around the area. Okay. And they said, this sounds an awful lot like Carmine Calabro. And sure enough, that's who it was.
Holy crap.
Are there any warning signs for people, like, if you know somebody that you can, like, kind of tell if a person can be a serial killer?
Well, that's a very interesting question.
People and around
people
them disappear.
People always ask, John, since we talk about traits that a lot of these guys have, and they're almost always guys, by the way, some women, but very few. People ask, well, how do you know? Can you tell from a young age? And John always says, I can tell who has the potential to become a serial or violent predator, but at that age, but so can any good elementary school teacher.
Right. And they say, killing animals, right?
Yeah,
torturing
absolutely.
Animals seems to always come up.
Yeah, we talk about the homicidal triad, which involves cruelty to animals and also to other children, late bedwetting, and setting fires for thrills. Now, obviously, kids set fires. Most of us did it one time or another.
Yep. I call
time
it cooking.
To time. Bedwetting is a little vaguer, but if you have a kid who is torturing or mistreating animals, that is an absolute red flag, and you need to look for intervention immediately.
All right, we won't talk to Phil about that
no,
right now.
No,
but, but is there a case or cases that John profiled someone and the cops are like, nah, you're wrong because it doesn't fit what we're looking at, and
sure.
then it turned out he was right?
Sure, that happens fairly frequently, and you know, everybody, all of us have confirmation bias. We have a certain idea of what we think. One of the cases that really opened the world of profiling up, and you guys all remember, I'm sure, was the Atlanta child killings in the 1980s. And there was a real concern that a Klan-type organization was killing black children in Atlanta, mostly boys, but boys and girls. They asked the FBI to come down there. John and his profiling partner, Roy Hazelwood, came down. First thing they said is, this is not a Klan activity. And unfortunately, you're dealing with a sole black young male offender. And they said that for a couple of reasons. First of all, they went to and looked at all the crime scene sites. they were in real ghetto-type neighborhoods. They said, with all of the abductions you've had here, if a white guy was doing this, somebody would have seen something.
Would have stuck out, yeah.
Yeah, but more important, and this is, again, from profiling and understanding the criminal's mind. If you have what we call a group cause homicide by extremists, which is how we would identify a Klan or white nationalist kind of killing, you would have a very symbolic presentation. You would have information of it. It would be like a lynching. It would be meant to create terror, to scare. There was none of these aspects were here. So based on the victimology, based on a number of other things, you know, which we can talk about, John concluded that it was a black male, I'm sorry. And as soon as the case progressed, he became convinced that this person was following the press, and therefore you can manipulate that person. And he finally manipulated him into dumping the bodies where the police would anticipate it. And that's how Wayne Williams was caught. Having said that, gentlemen, John and Roy also made the distinction that it's not only Wayne Williams. He was probably good for about 12 of the 20-some, and the others were either random or, in some cases, we believe, probably family murders. So you have to make that distinction, and you can't just take a broad brush approach to any of this.
So it sounds like he comes in, you know, I know he's an investigator, but he comes in as an investigator, keeps his mind open. I'm sure he has a hunch when he sees a couple of key things, but then he follows the evidence.
Sure. And in cases like we're talking about in this book, The Killer Across the Table, when he gets to these are crimes which have already been solved. These offenders are already in prison. So what John is interested in this case is, why did you do it? How did you do it? Why this particular victim? Why this particular time? For instance, the first case in the book is a man named Joseph McGowan, not too far from you guys, in New Jersey, actually. And unlike a lot of these people who are fringe, marginal people in society, McGowan is a very respected member of society. He is a high school science teacher with a master's degree, no criminal record, and yet when 7-year-old beautiful little girl, Joan D'Alessandro, who lives right around the corner from him, comes to his house to collect $2 from the sale of Girl Scout cookies, he says to John, "John, as soon as I saw her through the screen door, I knew I was going to kill her." Now, what makes somebody in that position, someone who's so invested in society and his own status, what makes him convinced at that moment that he's going to kill a completely innocent 7-year-old girl, sexually molest her, and then take her across state lines to bury her in a state park?
That's what
we need to know.
That was his first murder?
That was his first murder, and fortunately, since he was caught, it was his last murder. He's still in prison.
The answer to that question, why he would do that, is in that book?
The answer is in the book. It takes a long time for John and his colleagues to figure it out, but by understanding the case completely before you go into these interviews, understanding everything about it, by looking at all the crime scene photos, by looking at the autopsy protocols, by knowing everything about this guy and the people around him, you finally figure it out, and it's a contribution to criminal justice and criminal justice law, so that you can use it for future crimes.
I'm fascinated with this. I need to part 2, 3, and 4 with you, but one more question, then I'll let you go. Can a profiler be used in a one-off murder? Not a serial killer, but just one-off.
It depends, and that's a very interesting question. We always say that for a typical felony murder, a bank robbery, a street robbery, something like that, where there's nothing particularly unusual going on, it's very difficult because you don't have a lot of behavioral evidence. On the other hand, sometimes you get enough that you can say, well, we could give you a profile, but it would fit thousands of people, so it's not very useful. But what we can say is we can predict the kind of pre-offense and post-offense behavior that the police and people around this person would expect to see. And therefore, if you enlist the public, which we almost always believe in, enlisting the public, somebody will notice something and turn that person in.
This is fascinating.
Wow.
Mark, thank you so much for coming on. We're going to try to get you back on.
Yep.
You guys are great whenever you want.
Thank you.
Thank you
and
so much.
We're linked up to all things mindhuntersinc.com at WPLR.com.
The killer across
the table.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.